Well, up next with Linda Moulton Howe, an amazing story of how a mother may have come back from the dead momentarily to save her almost drowning baby. That story is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Linda, I've been following this story for, you know, at least a few months. It's an unbelievable story, and I'm glad you followed up with us.
Well, it's only a month and a half old.
Yeah.
It was by March 9th, 2015, that most of the world was seeing on internet and television the remarkable breaking news about a, quote, miracle in Spanish Fork, Utah. The news report showed a photo of 25-year-old Jennifer Groesbeck holding her 18-month-old daughter, Lily, close and lovingly. Around 10:30 p.m. Mountain Time on Friday night, March 6, 2015, Jennifer was heading north on Main Street near Arrowhead Trail in Spanish Fork, Utah, with her beloved daughter, Lily, strapped in her child carrier in the back seat. It's not clear exactly what happened, but sadly, police found in Jennifer Groesbeck's purse some marijuana, an unused package syringe, and bottle of tramadol, a painkiller. Whatever happened, Jennifer drove over a cement barrier down several feet into the river,
tragic,
landing upside down in the water, and I have a photograph from the Spanish Fork Police Department in my earthfiles.com report tonight, and you can see for yourself this car was upside down and a good deal of the car is underwater. And the photograph shows that.
Really was a sad story, too. You know, it brought tears to my eyes, Linda.
It absolutely. Everybody, I think, was just out of just glued to the TV about this. And in this situation, when you look at this photograph, you know that it is assumed that the mother driving the car died instantly. The temperature that night was in the low 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and the water was a frigid 40 degrees Fahrenheit. The car was not visible from the roadway and was not discovered until 14 hours later when a fisherman found it at 12:24 p.m. Saturday, March 7th, and called the police. Four Spanish Fork, Utah police officers and three firefighters responded. Those night temperatures in 20 degrees Fahrenheit range, they knew if anybody was in there, they might have succumbed to the temperatures. The first four officers en route learned that an observer could see an arm hanging from a car window. And when the officers got into the 40-degree Fahrenheit frigid river water, they all four, at the same time, quote, heard a distinct female voice from the car saying, "Help me. Help us." That is when the officers replied out loud. You could hear it on one of their lapel cameras. "We're trying to help you. We're trying our best to get you out." Spanish Fork Police Officer Tyler Beddoes said the female voice was, quote, "clear as day," close quote. They all heard it. That mysterious female voice increased the policeman's adrenaline, and they were able to pull this heavy waterlogged car at least up onto its side. And that's when they found the mother dead at the wheel and the 18-month-old baby girl still miraculously alive, but barely, in her infant car seat. All seven emergency responders had to be hospitalized themselves and treated for hypothermia after being in that cold river water. So how did this baby girl survive? They found her a few inches in her face from the water. She had been there for 14 hours, and part of her body was in the cold 40-degree Fahrenheit water when they got to her. Did her mother reach out from another dimension after the moment of her death to save her baby in this matter world? The March 7th to 8th, 2015 weekend that the Utah miracle news broke, I was talking with some investigators of near-death experiences, And one NDE experiencer told me about the, quote, reappearance phenomenon of loved ones seemingly in full flesh and able to communicate to survivors in the earth plane. Ironically, one clear example that was given occurred during a March 31st, 1997 Easter break celebration of resurrection. In northbound on I-15 from Salt Lake City towards Bountiful, Utah. Then 33-year-old Jeffrey Olson was driving his family home after the Easter holiday. His wife of 10 years, Tamara, was asleep in the front passenger seat. Their 7-year-old son, Spencer, and 14-month-old infant son, Griffin, were in the back seat. Suddenly, the car was rolling over and over and over at 75 miles an hour straight down that busy I-15 freeway. Here now is Jeffrey Olson from Farmington, Utah, to describe what he remembers at that moment.
The most disturbing part is I feel I may have dozed off at the wheel for that brief moment and swerved to the right and then overcorrected to the left, and the car began to roll down the road, propelled by the concrete at 75 miles per hour. The accident report estimated we probably rolled at least 6, maybe 8 times.
What is your memory?
I remember swerving. I remember going into the roll. I blacked out for most of the roll. When the car became still, I became more aware, not blacked out. The first thing I remember hearing was my 7-year-old crying in the back seat of the car. My initial thought was I've got to get to him, and that's when I realized that I could not move. At that point is when I realized that no one else was crying. Both my wife and my youngest, half the family, were gone. I was very aware of that. I felt it. In that absolute mayhem, I became almost calm, and yet I knew I was losing consciousness. And it felt to me as if I were being embraced by a bubble of light. I seemed to rise above the scene, and it was as if I was being held in this calming, loving light.
Were you looking down on the smashed car from above?
I knew that I was rising above it, but the bizarre thing to me is I couldn't make sense of how am I feeling this calm in what had taken place. I became aware that I was in this different realm. I had read about tunnel of light and these type of things. I didn't experience any of that. It was almost like stepping through a doorway. It's like, well, I was there and now I'm here. But my wife, who I knew was deceased at the scene, was there with me. We were able to converse. Some were spoken words, but more of it was an unspoken communication.
Why did you know that you were with your wife?
Well, I did see her. I mean, I was there, and at this point, I could see her very vividly. And she looked just like she did in this realm. I mean, there she was, but she was okay. Aside from the fact that she was quite upset and was saying to me, you've got to go. You've got to go back. You can't be here. She was upset, but we were conversing and communicating, but it was beyond verbal communication. It was almost like a nonverbal, intense knowing.
What was in the environment around you and her inside of this bubble?
Nothing at this point. It seemed as if we were simply surrounded by light.
Was the light a color?
A white light could have been gold in hue, but it was more the feeling than the look at it. It felt as if we were being held in comfort and love in spite of this horrific automobile accident.
As you are feeling this intensity from your wife in this bubble of light that you must go back, do you remember communicating anything to her before you left the bubble?
No, except I made the conscious decision to go back. I knew I was communicating love. I knew somehow that this was goodbye, and it was the most poignant goodbye I would ever say.
How long had you been married?
10 years.
And in those 10 years, you had the 7-year-old and the 14-month-old.
That's correct. What I later found out is people did arrive at the scene of the accident. They rushed us to a hospital. They could do nothing for me there because of the extent of my injuries. They life-flighted me into Salt Lake City. My 7-year-old son was also seen too, and he was relatively uninjured. He cracked his wrist, and he banged his ribs up pretty good, but I was unaware of any of that. All I knew is here I was saying this poignant goodbye, and then I found myself, as I made the conscious choice, what I knew is that I had to go back, and she was emphatic about that. You cannot be here. You cannot stay. You've got to go back. I knew I had a child crying in the back seat of that car, and I was looking at the woman I loved more than life, but knew I had to come back to my child. So that's when I became aware of a hospital. When I made the choice to come back, I found myself wandering through a hospital. And when I say that, I was freely moving through the hospital, encountering the doctors, the nurses, the patients, the families, you know, everything of a busy ER trauma setting. Everyone I saw, I knew them. I mean, I knew them perfectly, and I knew their love, their hate, their joy, their misery, their decisions, their motivations. I knew their very heart. I felt this absolute oneness, connection to them, and actually experienced an overwhelming, unconditional love for all of them. Everyone I saw, no matter what walk of life or station they held.
You are moving as if you were walking through the hospital?
Yeah, as if I was walking. I wasn't floating. It was as if I was walking, but I don't recall taking steps.
Do you think it was your soul, spirit disconnected from your broken body and it was trying to find and reunite with your body?
Absolutely, because eventually I came up on a body or a man laying on a bed that I didn't feel anything from like I was these other people I was encountering. So I stepped closer and looked, and indeed it was me or was my body. And I stood there looking at that, thinking, wow, what a mess. It was a wreck. And feeling an overwhelming sense of sadness over what had taken place, knowing I had to get back in that body.
What happened microsecond by microsecond of being outside of the body that you're looking at through your soul spirit eyes and having to get inside of that body?
I was looking at that body and remembering things from my life and feeling that life was such a gift. Now I've got to get back in there and it's going to be completely different. My body will never be the same. I'd been a Division I athlete, and now I knew I would be somewhat crippled, or I certainly wouldn't get around the way I used to. And it was as quick as a conscious decision. It's like as soon as I made the choice, I'm getting back in the body, boom. Then I was back in the body to the pain, the guilt, the trauma, all that had happened, and I was ventilated. You know, there was a respirator doing the breathing for me. My legs were immobile, crushed and shattered. My right arm was immobile.
Now back in this broken, cut, maimed body, did you preserve both the perspective from outside the body and now inside the body?
I did. I knew I had been out of the body, and in fact, I was in the hospital for almost 6 months, 18 surgeries as they pieced me back together.
Could you describe what the nurse and the doctor communicated to you about what they experienced in that surgery room with you?
Yes. The nurse explained that as she came into that triage area, that she seemed to see that I was surrounded by light, and she felt an intense love, and that she saw the soul of my deceased wife there with me. She communicated that she found it so profound, she ran to get the doctor. Come quick, you've got to see what's going on down here. The doctor then spoke up, and he said, I didn't see anything, but he said, I felt something. And he said, I felt as if it was your deceased wife communicating to me, letting me know, not with words, but he said, I knew that it was imperative that we save you. And he did say, you were in pretty rough shape. We were not sure if you were going to make it. She was begging that we save you, that we go to all measures to get you well. He said, the interesting thing is, as I worked on you and was assessing the injuries and working with you, I felt her or heard her say, thank you. And that's when I burst into tears. That's what she would do. The doctor said, we're just shocked you're alive. I haven't seen anyone with your injuries alive, let alone survive them. So I had two clinicians show up who were saying, hey, we experienced something very interesting at the same time, which was unique.
What do you think happens at the moment of death?
Well, for me, if I truly left the body and died and I was on the side of the road, how could I feel calm, feeling that everything was okay? And yet if that's the point that my soul left my body, I would say my experience is that it's okay, that it's calming, that it's a return, and the feeling I got is home. I had been there. It was welcoming. I was home.
Then what do you think life in this dimension is about?
Over those months in the hospital, I would come back and forth. I had some profound interactions with the other side. And the only thing I was ever asked is, to what degree have you learned to love? And that may sound sappy, but however it sounds, I'll tell you what, I have fully embraced that this realm is simply for us to learn. And I think what we're here to learn is to love, and not only other people, but ourselves, and realize that we're simply having an experience. You know, we come here to, in some ways, experience what we're not, that we can embrace what we truly are. And in my experience, that is divine. We are part of that. We come from that realm. We are that realm, and we're here playing this crazy game we call life. Simply learn to love, to forgive, and to create a more heavenly place here. In other words, there may not be anywhere to go. Maybe we're meant to create it right here and experience it here, and that might be the crazy game we're playing.
And the wife of Jeff, he told me, appeared solid to him, alive to him, and communicated with the strength that he knew in her that he had to get back in his body. And the impression that he got was because he had to take care of their surviving 7-year-old, and that he and she, they communicated, she to him, the baby, the young son, was with her and was fine in whatever dimension that she was in. And then you have the nurse in the surgery room who sees a solid-looking woman in light next to Jeff Olson, and the surgeon feels a presence, and then both the nurse and the doctors hear the wife urge them with an impression inside of them to keep her husband alive, and they hear the words, thank you. Now, what is the physics of this? How does, after the moment of death, whatever that is, interact with this matter world? Is it different from the third man factor that has been written about, of explorers such as Shackleton and others that find themselves in remote places and they are desperate for help and there is no possibility of something dropping down food or keeping them going, and yet they feel a presence that is so close that in one case in the 1930s, a person who was high up on a mountain actually gave, perhaps disoriented, but broke a piece of food to hand to the person that they were relating as being with them, comforting them, helping them, protecting them, and at that moment, handing the food, realized no one was there. What is that third man factor that is different from what happened with Jeff Olson, what happened with the woman and her baby in Spanish Fork, Utah? That's next.
We shall be back. And of course, you've watched our television show, Beyond Belief. If you haven't, you just go to the website, sign up for it. It's a fun show, beyondbelief.com. Welcome back. George Norrie here, along with Linda Moulton. Now, Linda, you've become sort of an expert in the afterlife now.
Well, I've always been interested in the moment of death because it's part of life and it is a mystery to every person who has ever lived. What does happen at the moment of death? Is there a continuation? Is reincarnation real? The cycling of the soul spirit in and out of containers endlessly through eternity? Is that part of the machinery of the divine field? Is that the big cosmos that we are not always aware of in a literal sense here? And before the break, I was raising that question of what is the difference between the flesh-looking, communicating of people, the influence on the baby, perhaps from the mother in another dimension who kept the baby alive, and a concept that has been around for quite a while called the third man. It came from that great poet, T.S. Eliot, writing about the 1916 expedition to Antarctica by explorer Ernest Shackleton. And he and others were close to death, but miraculously, they managed to survive. And a few weeks after their nearly fatal adventure in that very cold land, Shackleton and two of his colleagues finally talked publicly. And they reported an uncanny, what they called an experience, during their trek. They said it was a feeling that, quote, often there were four, not three men on this journey. The fourth that accompanied us had the silent presence of a real person, someone that was walking with them by their side as far as the whaling station that they finally made it to that kept them alive, but no further after that. And Shackleton was so affected by this experience, he would say little about it, but he considered it something which kept him alive. And when Eliot, reading about what had happened to Shackleton and these men, and when they made these public statements about this unseen presence, it was T.S. Eliot who wrote this one paragraph in his famous Wasteland, quote, "Who is the third who walks always beside you? When I count, there are only you and I together. But when I look ahead up the white road, there is always another one walking beside you. Who is that?" And there is an author, John Geiger. He is the author of two books related to all of these questions. One is called The Third Man, and the other one that he has done is called The Angel Effect. And I talked with him recently about all of this and what was it in his own life as an adventurer and working with the National Geographic office in Canada, what was it that provoked him to go into and write about the third man and the angel effect? So here now from Canada is John Geiger.
I was involved in an expedition to a place called Marble Island, which is a very desolate outcrop in Hudson Bay. Temperature is extreme cold, and during a period where all of us got soaked, I found myself unable to get dry and to warm up, and it was very cold in a one-man tent. And I became, I think, hypothermic. I was, you know, shivering sort of rhythmically, and I found myself in a situation where, oddly, I felt like detached, or part of me detached from myself. I remember I had the experience of looking down in the tent at myself, shaking, detachment and separation, and then oddly found that comforting. And, you know, after that experience, when I came out of the Arctic, I began to explore this whole idea of the psychological impact of exploration on individuals. There are very specific examples of people who are in life and death struggles where this presence or angel, call it what you will, actually gives specific advice, takes someone by the hand and directs them. I would say 90 or 95% of the cases I've looked at, it's highly unusual for a person to actually see something. There are examples of it, but generally speaking, you sense the presence. It's there, and it's there in a way that there's no doubt that there is an entity with you, but it's not something you see.
Can you describe the most powerful third man that you have written about in your book?
One of them involved the 9/11 attacks, where Ron DeFrancesco, who was working in the South Tower of the World Trade Center, found himself above the impact point in the South Tower after the plane collided with that building, and found himself trapped above with many other people. He initially attempted to go down the stairwell and try to get out, but found flames and other people coming up saying, it's impossible. We can't get out. It's blocked. There's fire. We have to go up. And they went up on a number of flights of stairs higher in the building, but their stairwell was filled with smoke. And at some point, Ron felt that there was no escaping by going up. And he turned around and went back down towards where the debris and the fire was. And he found some people unconscious there, slumped on the landing. And he realized at that point, he felt that he would not be able to escape the situation. He was being overcome by the smoke. And then he had a sense of a powerful being. Someone else joined him there on that landing. He was urged to get up. He said that he mentally heard get up. And he was led down further into the fire. During this period, again, he felt helped, encouraged, directed, and instructed to enter into the fire and fight his way through the debris, which he did. And he eventually came out on the other side of this, and the lights were on, and he was able to get below this damage and was able to get out just as the coast tower began to collapse. He would feel very strongly that it was an angel that had intervened on his behalf.
For you, what is an angel?
Something greater than oneself that intervenes at critical moments in our lives to help us. There's a point we reach where we no longer have the capacity to help ourselves, whether in a car or in a river. We are alone in situations where we are beyond the ability to help ourselves, and yet somehow help is found. Like there's a hand that reaches down at that moment. That's certainly a very powerful thought, to think that we are never truly alone, that we all potentially have the capacity to reach out and to be touched in this way by something. I can't explain the spiritual aspects of this. It may well yet be proven medically or through neurological research that this is a brain function that is perhaps some evolutionary development to help us in these situations.
But Eben Alexander, the neurosurgeon who wrote the book Proof of Heaven, he was technically, medically dead in his brain when he had these extraordinary experiences that he wrote about in Proof of Heaven.
That's right. So I certainly think that there are different theories. It may well be shown at some point that there is an organic basis to these experiences, but at the moment, the evidence is all pointing towards something greater than that, something that we can't really grasp.
In the angelic realm of another dimension.
That's right.
You know, I've often wondered if we are not understanding really what happens at the moment of death. I mean, the concept of the soul separating from the body is very ancient, and you yourself had the out-of-body when you were in the tent, wet and shivering, and you could see your body looking down from above, and you felt comfort from that.
Yeah.
And what I thought about the recent Spanish Forks, Utah trauma, that sometimes at the moment of death, maybe there is a conscious separation of the body container and the soul spirit. And what could be more compelling to a dying mother than keeping her 18-month-old baby girl alive? And somehow there must be a physics in that dimensional separation in which the mother's soul spirit could work to try to keep that baby alive during the frigid night, could direct the fishermen to find the car under the bridge, and could inspire the police department to send four officers. All four policemen told reporters that they heard a female voice call out, "Help me, please help us." And the officers said it was that pleading female voice that gave them adrenaline to move in the cold water to the car. And there, the mother is dead at the wheel. The little baby girl in the back is nearly dead, strapped in her car seat, and she was even in cold water then. Maybe it's as if the mother in the soul spirit dimension was responsible for all of those ingredients coming together over 14 hours, including calling out for help from an after-death dimension. And all four policemen heard an audible female voice.
That is certainly a possibility. What I do know is that there's a case called the Tucson Nun, where a woman was in a terrible car accident and was very seriously injured. She was alone in the car, but she felt, while she was trapped in the wreckage, and she was trapped, rescue worker had to use the jaws of life to physically cut her out of the vehicle. But she felt the entire time that she was in the wreckage of her car that someone else had sat down next to her in the passenger seat and had held her hand and had spoken to her and told her to calm down, to breathe slowly. She said that this, to her, was a real tangible person, someone in authority who knew exactly what to do in order to survive. That presence stayed with her for half an hour until she was finally removed from the wreckage. And she said that without that encouragement, without the advice to slow her breathing and to calm herself, that she would have likely died. When she did finally regain consciousness, she asked, who was it who was with her in the car? That became an obsession for her to find out this woman who'd been with her. She felt it was a nun. The rescue workers were eventually tracked down, and they said there was nobody in the car with you. You were alone. It was impossible to get in the car, and it was almost impossible to get you out of the car.
What do you hypothesize is the physics at work between the matter world and our consciousness now versus the moment of death and these examples of something in the unseen in what you would think is some sort of other dimensional frequency being able to interact with this matter world?
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, there are a number of different neurological and psychological theories as to what's happening. So this has happened with enough frequency to highly credible people that science is now taking a close look at it. The theories are out there. One of them involves what's called the hypersensitive agent detection device, or HAD, which is an ancient part of our neurological makeup that seems to be a way that humans develop to protect themselves against predators and against enemies.
But John, the sense of this has to be of a presence, which means there is something else there. It isn't just inside the mind of the person.
Yeah, that's right. In every one of these explanations, they get you to the point where we do know that you can evoke a presence through the brain. If you stimulate the temporal parietal junction of the brain, you can actually evoke a sense of a presence. But the presence is invariably creepy, unsettling. It's not benign or benevolent. It's not a very good experience to have. This has actually been replicated in a lab in Switzerland, but it's not the same experience. The person is not describing the power and the benefit that people in these terrible situations, suffering tremendous levels of stress and experience a great comforting, benevolent power that intervenes and helps them, sometimes gives them very specific tips as to how to survive. Science has taken a couple steps in that direction, but it certainly in no way explains the phenomenon.
And George, the physics of all of this is what really provokes me. And I think probably the top one or two books that I have ever read in my life is by David Bohm. It's called Wholeness and the Implicate Order. And he wrote this in 1980, and there was one section where he does a fascinating description of an experiment to do in a lab trying to get across the idea of what the implicate order enfolded and unenfolded means. And he said, if you take two glass cylinders, one smaller than the other, and place the smaller inside the larger and fill the space between with glycerin, which is a colorless, thick, kind of viscous fluid, and then introduce a drop of ink into the glycerin and revolve the outer cylinder. As you do this, the ink will stretch into a thread, growing longer, thinner, and fainter until it completely disappears. The ink is now enfolded into the glycerin. You can no longer see it, but you know it is there. But where is it? It is no longer in any single position. It is spread out nowhere and everywhere. In extensive research here and abroad, there is much evidence to suggest that everything that exists today or ever did exist is similarly enfolded in an invisible medium. We become aware of things only when they are unenfolded out of the invisible medium into our reality. Now, if you reverse the direction of the cylinders, the thread of ink begins to reappear, much as if a film of the unfolding process were being run backwards. One could unfold any number of ink droplets into the medium, and by turning the cylinder backward very rapidly, they would suddenly appear as out of nowhere. This is the mechanism of how we become aware of the reality in our world, enfolding and unenfolding the ink drops, and the glycerin is comparable to the enfolding and unenfolding an object backwards and forwards through time and space. Everything exists everywhere at once, enfolded into an invisible, seemingly timeless medium. And for me, this could explain how many dimensions, and this is Linda talking, could be layered together, including where we go after the moment of death, and that the physics of the universe, once upon a time, I used to puzzle over that statement, from the Alpha to the Omega, all that has been and that all that ever will be is already there. That's a very difficult statement to comprehend.
Sure is.
But when you contemplate David Bohm's ink experiment, that you could wind into, enfold into maybe an infinite number of dimensions, and then unenfold a process in which all that has ever been and ever will be will appear. Somehow, I think this is getting closer to what might be the dynamic in the machinery between this reality in this matter world and another reality in another dimensional world that is related to what the soul does in the matter containers during life and then evolves into yet other different dimensions after the container is gone, but that the soul continues to recycle and grow and learn, maybe forever.
And knowing you, Linda, you're going to report on the other side for us one day.
I'd like to keep going forever, yes.
That would be something indeed. Well, a series of great reports. We're going to come back and take conversations with Linda next on Coast to Coast AM. If you're a whistleblower, maybe you want to share a story, or you just have a plain question for Linda, Linda Moulton Howe. She's not going to give us a report in May because she'll be on assignment. She'll talk about that in a second as well.